This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
Mason Payne here live from the NVP studios in Chicago, and thank you for tuning in. COVID-19 is considered a pandemic, but there's a lot of misconceptions surrounding this virus. Core faculty member for Walden University, Dr. Amy Ferrero, joins me to separate fact from fiction about COVID-19. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Ferrero.
Thanks for having me.
So some people think, because all you've really been seeing in the news is that only older people who are like 60 plus are getting affected by COVID-19. Is this true?
There is some truth to that. The majority of deaths have been occurring in people over the age of 50, really. And there's currently been no reports of deaths among children under the age of 10. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't some coming. I think in the last few days, we're starting to see reports of some younger cases coming through. And really, the case of having older people dying more from these kinds of diseases is similar to patterns we see with other infectious diseases like measles and SARS and MERS, which are previous versions of the coronavirus.
Now, when it comes to people with pre-existing conditions, like they're diabetic or something that suppresses their immune system, obviously they're at risk, even if they're younger. But it turns out that people who are completely healthy are getting this. Is this true, or there's not too much information yet?
We're seeing all sorts of cases coming in. I think what's interesting is that the data that came out from China was showing certain kinds of demographics, and it was trending towards the elderly and immune compromised. It would be people that had things like cardiovascular disease or diabetes or cancer were at increased risk for infection and death. But in the United States, we're starting to see some different numbers come out. And maybe if we could look at some analysis of Italy or Spain, other countries that are currently going through the depths of the pandemic, they're going to start to show different results as well. And so I think the trend is going to be a bit different for the United States for a number of reasons. Number one, there's a lot more obesity, and that would be considered one of those pre-existing conditions. There may be increased rates of smoking or vaping, which are both behaviors that could impact the lungs. And since this is a respiratory illness, anything that's going to sort of already take a hit to the lungs is going to increase your risk of developing a more serious illness.
Now, there have been debates amongst my friends, people on the internet, all over the place, really. Is COVID-19 airborne?
Yeah, this is a good question. So there's been a number of studies coming out recently trying to figure out exactly how long it stays on surfaces. And one of them showed that it could stay in aerosolized form for up to like 3 hours. And so it's not really an airborne illness. That's not what we call it in epidemiological terms. Really, it's the primary mode of transmission is from respiratory droplets from an infected person, and those droplets contain the virus, and they will spread to another person if they, you know, make direct contact with that, or possibly it would be if those droplets land on something, another person touches those droplets and then somehow puts it into their mouth or their eyes or their nose. It's really the virus sits within these respiratory droplets, and it's not just going to stay in the air for very long, because they're probably fairly heavy and gravity will pull them down somewhere. So we typically call this a person-to-person transmission primarily. There may be some other community spread from surfaces, but that's very rare. And we don't have any indications yet that somebody for certain has gotten it from an airborne transmission.
Okay, so this is blowing my mind. You mean to tell me a mist of saliva is just hanging and floating around in the air?
Yeah, well, probably not, though. I mean, technically, it could, but it's most likely that it's going to drop to the ground or some surface nearby. I think they've been doing these studies to determine, okay, if somebody sneezes, exactly how far does it go? How long does it stay in the air? And they've shown that it tends to travel up to 6 feet a sneeze, and that's when we're talking about social distancing, is trying to maintain, you know, this 2 meters or 6 feet from other person. Maybe it's important to note that there are other infections that do stay in the air in aerosolized form, and measles would be one of those. It has shown that virus is a bit smaller, and so it can remain sort of in air particles for up to about 2 hours, and that's why it's even more contagious than what we're seeing with coronavirus here.
COVID-19 just sits on a surface. How safe are face guards then?
Yeah, this is a good question, and I get that a lot. Or do I have to be worried about it on my clothes? So I think what's important to remember here is face masks were originally developed for doctors to protect their patients from getting something that the doctor might have. So the face mask isn't to protect you from getting something in the air. It's to stop you from passing your respiratory droplets to others. I think we need to consider using face masks only if we are actually sick ourselves, and not to try and prevent us from getting things out in the air, because it's very unlikely that that's how you're going to get the infection. And we need to save the face masks for the people who really need them, which are the healthcare providers right now.
I've read that people who get COVID-19, you're more likely to be a man than a woman to get it. Is this true?
That's another one where we're starting to see some data to show that men are at slightly increased risk for COVID-19 in China. And now even some data coming from the United States, it's showing that men are accounting for about 60% of the infections and 70% of the deaths. So it's not only that they're a little bit more likely to get infected, but if they do get infected, they're more likely to die. And we have maybe a couple of theories. We don't know exactly why that's happening, but one theory might be that men smoke at greater rates than women, and so their lungs are already, you know, affected, and it puts them at increased risk for more severe illness. Then another theory, and this has only been shown maybe in animal studies, is that estrogen, which women have more of than men, could be protective against some sorts of coronaviruses. And so it could be that hormones can play a role in immune protection or just even helping to fight against coronaviruses in some way.
Now, this was a flash in the pan kind of rumor. It was here and gone, but I'm still a little curious about it. China came out saying that men can get sterile when they recover from COVID-19. Is that still true, or is it just a rumor at this point?
I've not read that in medical literature, so I suspect that would be one of those myths that was maybe passed around through the lovely Facebook or memes or something. But no, I have not read any reports of that.
Okay, well, here's another one for you. COVID-19, is it transmittable between humans to animals?
First, I think it's important to point out the fact that so COVID-19, the original source of this, we believe to be a zoonotic disease, which means it came from an animal source. And so the investigators in China suspect that it came from a live animal market in the city of Wuhan. And so this happens sometimes where coronaviruses exist in an animal source. And as humans get closer to those animal sources, you know, it could be the workers that were cutting these live animals. They suspect maybe it's bats or something like this. Somehow it gets transmitted into humans. And then from there, it spread from person-to-person contact. So we don't have any indication, any reports, that it's reversing and going from humans back into animals, at least not for this one. But, you know, this is still something that a lot of animals do have coronaviruses that exist just in their animal sources. So dogs and cats do have certain kind of coronaviruses, but they typically don't jump from those animals into the humans. It's just these rare instances like we're seeing with this coronavirus where that's happened.
So in theories, if we get rid of COVID-19 and get a vaccine, there could be another coronavirus out there that can come back to us?
Yes, yes. And in theory, they could make a vaccine for COVID-19. And by the time they're ready to distribute it, it could have slightly changed a little bit. These vaccines are evolving pretty rapidly in some cases. I read some studies that show that maybe there's two forms of this COVID-19, that there's one that had a genetic makeup that was typical to China and Asia, but what we're seeing over in the Americas and in Europe is slightly different. So this is why when we get the influenza vaccine, it's different every year. It's constantly evolving. These viruses are very quick. They have maybe genetic mutations that change them, or they're just smarter than we are at evolving more rapidly so that they can continue living. So yes, there is a big possibility that there will be future coronaviruses that will be slightly different than this one.
Now, how long do vaccinations usually take to get created? I mean, is it a couple months? And in this case, I mean, everything's getting expedited, but usually how long does it take?
Usually it can take years. There's several phases that vaccines go through when they're developed. First, it'll start in the laboratory where they have to develop it and, you know, make sure it actually stays in place in whatever format they're going to use. There's different kinds of vaccines. Some of them use the genetic material. Some of them use immune material, the antibodies. And so first they have to formulate it. That can take months to years sometimes. In this case, they've already done that in about a month. And then it goes into a phase where they need to test it in animals to make sure it's actually safe and doesn't kill somebody. Those usually take months to a year to happen, and they're trying to expedite those as well. The next phase goes into humans, and they're just to try and see that it actually works and it doesn't have severe side effects. And then the last phase goes into a broader population and where you start to see, again, more of those, like you'd monitor to make sure it doesn't have more severe side effects, that it's actually working correctly, and you need larger numbers. And that goes into things like statistics. And do you have enough power to say that there's, you know, a significant difference? So those can take from start to finish 5 to 10 years sometimes. I think they've been working on a dengue vaccine for that long, and they still don't have one that's definitively proven to work. So they have to go back to the drawing board and start again. On this one, I think because it's a public health emergency, they're going to try and bypass those slow-moving stop gaps in between things and say, okay, you got the lab results. Let's move it right into animal studies. We got a week worth of animal studies through, and it doesn't kill anybody. Let's move on to putting it in humans. So I think there's already a trial going on in Seattle, if I'm correct, and in China. And so hopefully they're looking at, I think the best estimate is that within 12 months they could have a vaccine. But that's if nothing goes wrong, if these initial trials show effectiveness. So we'll have to wait and see. Beyond that, I think they've been giving a 12 to 18 month range before a vaccine is made.
And that's fast.
It is fast. Yeah, it would be years normally. So some people work an entire career on something like this. So to see it come out that quickly is kind of amazing.
Wow. It's kind of like we needed it yesterday. But you know, 18 yeah. months, that's still good, right?
I guess, you know. And then there's the other side of it is working on the antiretrovirals, or the more, sorry, not retroviral, but antivirals would be the treatment for this. So there's a couple of ways to combat this. Everybody's talking about we need to maintain social distancing to try and flatten the curve. You know, reduce the number of cases that end up in the hospital and overwhelm our system. And we have to do that until we get this vaccine. But the other side of the coin could be we come up with a great treatment. So, okay, people get sick. But if we know that there's an antiviral out there that could combat the disease quickly, then we could also reduce the number of cases that end up in death. I think there's a number of trials going on with that as well. These hydroxychloroquine, which is a malarial drug, is being tested right now. And they tried one for HIV in China. That one was not effective. So there's a couple of studies around the world that are trying to find a treatment just as quickly as they're trying to find the vaccine.
Well, Dr. Ferraro, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you being here. For those listening, where can they find more information about you?
Well, you can find more information about myself. I'm a professor in public health at Walden University. I also encourage people to go look at sources like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention or the World Health Organization for more information on this, and try not to rely just on things like Facebook.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapaine.com. That's MasonVeraPaine.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.